Welcome to the latest Watercolors Aquarium Gallery podcast brought to you from the Aquarium Rush Studios in Grand Rapids, Michigan. My name is Ben.
I'm Amy.
And I'm Charles.
What do we got going on in the store?
It's kind of a momentous day in the store today.
Yeah?
Our plant propagation specialist brought up the first plants from our plant propagation system.
Nice.
And also our biotope specialist finally got the gorgeous light on his biotope. I can't believe how cool that looks.
That is looking amazing.
It absolutely looks like a river in natural sunlight to me. Nice. It's so cool.
I can't convey it in audio, so wait for the video, but the way that light makes the water shimmer with the way that the outflow, that filter is going, it looks amazing.
I think that's something that a lot of aquascapers miss is lighting effects.
Yeah.
And I think this is going to kind of show off lighting effects. It's sweet.
When I turned the corner right after you set it up and it almost gave me chills a little bit. I was like, ooh, that's cool.
I love it.
Yeah. I'm really excited about that one.
I love it.
Cool. What are we talking about today?
So I think I have a cool introduction, so I'm going to run with it.
Okay.
Don't edit that out.
It's so amazing when we get people in. And actually today, I had somebody in the store today talking about they were doing salt water and his girlfriend or wife or significant other was doing fresh water. And he said, yeah, I graduated to salt water from fresh water. And that's such a common, I think, misunderstanding of fresh water. It's like, hey, I'm good at salt water or fresh water, so now I can do salt water. And I don't think people realize that the average life of a saltwater aquarium hobbyist is about 4 years. That's pushing it.
Yeah.
That's somebody who like really gets into it.
That's if you take into account that some people are 30 years and some people are a month.
Yeah. The average life of a freshwater hobbyist is more like 10 years. People really get into it. And the reason is there's so much more to do in freshwater. Yes, I said that. There's so much more to do in freshwater. There's so many more ecosystems to emulate. There's so many more different species of fish to keep and to display and to try and breed. And that leads me into the topic for the day. We're going to talk about, we're doing one of our famous top five lists. What we think is our top five easiest fish to breed.
Yeah, I don't think mine are the top, well, maybe they are. Maybe not the easiest fish to breed, but they're definitely my top five easy breeders. Like, I don't know.
I think that's valid. I'll specifically say that I went out of my way, so to speak, to exclude any live bearers from my list because for me, I don't really consider that breeding in the spirit that I like to breed because you really don't have to do anything. And that's not a snub against people who do live bearers. That's just me saying, I don't feel like I did anything. I don't feel like I was a part of this process. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And so it's just, it's not the type of breeding I like to do in my fish room.
Live bearers kind of miss that crucial teeny tiny fish stage.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I know what you're talking about.
And that's the phase that I'm like, wow, that thing exists because I managed to succeed. Like that just, I don't know. There's a certain pride in that for me.
There are live bear breeders everywhere right now that are shaking their fist at you, just so you know that.
Yeah, I know.
I hope they write in.
for good reason.
Listen, if you're mad at Charles and you want him to know how you feel about him, please email podcast@watercolorsaquariumgallery.com and I will pass on the message.
I'm really hoping that like a couple of weeks from now, we'll actually have Amy is like, so I have a few questions for you. First off, who do you think you are?
Let's find a really tricky live bear to get Charles on breeding.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, yeah. There are definitely tricky ones. I'm just saying that when I'm going through a list of easy live bears, those are not fish that I want to try and breed in my space. So no. I didn't put them on my list.
I actually didn't end up with any live bears on my list either, but it wasn't really necessarily on purpose. I approached it from the perspective of, I think one of people's main concerns about breeding, especially easy breeders, quote unquote, is what do I do with them? And so I tried to aim for fish that I thought were desirable to trade into fish stores that they're kind of always looking for more of. I don't know. That was just one of the perspectives that I was considering when I was doing it.
See, this is why these lists are so valuable because we all went at this at a very different way.
Yeah. I just had a hard time narrowing it down to just five.
Yeah.
So I still have my list here, and there's more than five on there. So I can narrow it. Like, if somebody steals one of mine, I can just pretend it wasn't on my list.
Well, I guarantee there's going to be overlap in some of these.
Yeah, but I'm cheating, and I'm excusing it right now.
That's fine. Oh, we have to talk about more fish. Boo.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I do want to get back to something you mentioned earlier, though, where you said that there's more to do with freshwater. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, everyone's shocked when I tell them that.
Right.
And I'm like, well, with the freshwater fish keeping world, we are tapping into, like, I'm not going to say most, but many different types of ecosystems for the freshwater hobby. Whereas in the saltwater hobby, we're like, so tropical Pacific reef-dwelling fish or fish that live just outside the reef.
Yeah, and like specifically shallow, that's usually what we're doing.
Yeah, and so people are like, the ocean's so much bigger. And I'm like, yeah, it is. But we're also only taking from one habitat.
And that habitat is huge, but the parameters are all exactly the same.
Right.
When I tell people that we can probably, my best guess is we can probably get in about like 10 to 12 times more freshwater fish species in the store in any given week than we could saltwater.
Easily.
Definitely.
So I just wanted to harp on that. Let's move on.
I like it. I like it.
Yeah, that was a great point, by the way.
Yeah, I like it. All right. So let's get into it. Amy, you start.
All right. I started with the classic Crebensis cichlids.
Nice.
These ones are really fun to me because they give you a lot of the behaviors that you can see in the more complicated fish to breed. They do exhibit parental care. They're really good parents, which means that they do a lot of the work for you in getting the fry from the egg to the size where you can actually feed them. They will defend them, sometimes a little bit too much, but not too much for most communities. So you can breed them in a community setup. You don't always need to set up a separate tank. And they fit in so many communities. So I think they're a great starter because you don't need to set up a second tank, not all the time.
I think that you've chosen a really cool, valuable, easy breeding cichlid. That was a good call. I like it.
Almost put it on my list and I didn't because I knew it was going to be on yours. But I just want to talk about it a little bit where I originally tried to put a dwarf cichlid on, but then I realized that most of the ones that I like, you need to modify the water around here a little bit to get them to breed. But cribs, you don't have to.
Yeah, and chances are there's locally bred ones available because every club has at least five people who are breeding Crebensis.
I think that's probably true.
That cuts out, you don't need to worry really about your water parameters with cribs, right. Especially if they're locally bred, you'll be fine.
Yep.
Have two of them, have a cave, babies.
They'll make babies.
And from what I've been told from people in the club, basically anything in the Pelvicochromis genus is more or less the same.
Yeah, except for I think a lot of them are still wild caught, there might be some tricky water there, but if you're willing to accept that challenge, I think they're just as easy.
Well, from what I've been told, at least the people I know who succeeded, they didn't do anything with the water.
Really?
With their wild ones. They just kept it clean. So I'm like, I'm not going to guarantee success if you work with a wild caught one, but I'm saying I think that it's very feasible.
So at least worth putting to the test.
I think we need to write down that... We need to bring in some wild-caught Pelvicochromis for Charles to put into the breeding lab and see if he can put his money where his mouth is.
Yeah, that would be really cool. I mean, and there are so many different cool color combinations and stuff that the cribs alone, I mean, they're gorgeous. That bright pink belly, they're colorful fish, and they look a lot harder to keep than they are, I think.
Yep, I agree.
The Enigmatochromis, did I say that right?
Yeah.
Do those require any, I genuinely don't know, do they require any weird water?
There's not that much out there on them. People say that they do, but also the people who say that they do, I don't know that I've seen them report breeding them either.
Okay.
So I think they're just going by where they're naturally found.
All right. People in GVAC, get on it.
Yeah. Enigmatochromis lucanusi is the one he's talking about. And the coloration on that fish is crazy for a freshwater fish.
Yeah. They're
the females are like pink and blue.
Oh yeah.
Weird fish. Funky. Very cool.
Very Every funky. Time I walk by them, I'm kind of like, I do a little double take, what like, what is that? Just doesn't quite look right.
Yeah. Do we have them right now?
Mm-hmm. We do.
Oh, well, find a pair and breed them.
Yeah, they're still little right now, but they don't get that big. They actually stay a little smaller than cribs.
Perfect.
And cribs, that's a terrible, they're not really, not right. No part of them is Crebensis. They're Pelvicochromis pulcher. There is a Pelvicochromis Crebensis, and that's not the fish I'm referring to.
Right.
Referring to Pelvicochromis pulcher. Although, the Crebensis one, I'm sure, is just as easy.
Cobensis, so there's like 8 or 10 different populations of fish that are currently described as public Acromis cobensis, and probably will be divided into different species as the splitters get a hold of it. The lumpers tried to keep them all cobensis, and the splitters are saying, nope, 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 here's why.
I believe it. That whole region of the world is like almost, I don't want to say untapped by hobbyists, but there's so much potential there in that Congo River Basin and West African area that we don't get access to that often.
A lot of it has been conflict zones, and there's some newfound peace in some new areas, and that's why we're getting new stuff out of there and new studying is happening.
Yeah, it's not as big, but it has similar complexity in the system to like the Amazon River Basin. Yeah,
for sure.
Cool.
I love it.
My first one is, I'm going to say anything in the Nothobranchius genus.
You're calling those easy, huh?
For me, I just haven't had any problem working with them. And maybe it's just the type of the way I like to run my fish room, but like the peat spawning, dirt diving, substrate diving, whatever you want to call them, killifish have just like innately been easier for me to work with in the way I keep my tanks.
Babies are sometimes a little tricky to raise. That's the only reason that I'm kind of challenging the...
Maybe it's a bias because I work with bettas and they're pretty small when they first hatch.
Right. Well, maybe describe your methods and then people will be able to determine themselves whether that's easy or not.
Yeah. So the Nothobranchius genus of killies, they are a substrate spawning killie. I just use like little deli cups with like an inch of... I use compressed bricks of terrarium coconut husk substrate because, and yes, the compressed brick part is important. My experience so far has been that that sinks way better than the non-compressed bricks. I don't know what that does to it, but you fill in those little deli cups and you'll leave them in the tank. And I use 2.5 gallon tanks for my pairs and leave that little cup in there for about a week or two, pull it out, dry it up. And most Nothos, they incubate for about 12 weeks. So I'll leave mine in a bag labeled for the date when they're ready to go with the species name so you don't mix them up. And then when the time comes, just put it in a little basin of water, let them hatch out, and then start feeding them. I feed Moina, and I get them pretty quickly onto flake foods, actually.
Okay. But there is that live foods element, so if you've got that available to you, do you think they would take the quote unquote easier live foods like microworms?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
I've been messing around with the. We have very kindly had several people from the club in the last few weeks offer me vinegar eels and microworms, and I've been toying with them a little bit. Nothing turns down those microworms. If it's small enough to be in their wheelhouse, they're going for it.
And those young fry, they're small. They're the right size to take them?
Definitely.
Cool. That to me makes them much easier than if you've got to deal with Moina.
Yeah.
Try mixing in a little frozen Daphnia and see if you can get a batch or two on frozen Daphnia, because that can be a game changer for people that just can't stand live food.
Yeah.
It's a good idea.
Yeah.
Or maybe even like frozen baby brine. I wonder if that would be a little bit better.
I definitely had more success with frozen Daphnia than I did with frozen baby brine shrimp.
Okay.
Yep.
Interesting.
Yep.
That's only fascinating to me because with betta fry, I've done better with frozen baby brine.
I wonder if I guess it would be different with that, but the Daphnia is so close to what they're going to have as a first food in the wild.
Yeah. And that's just what's fascinating to me. Yeah. It's like, well, apparently bettas do better with a little bit more fat in their diet when they're young. And
right.
That's just interesting.
Yeah.
And they just know what they want or what they don't.
Cool. So anyways, that's my process. I've done pretty well with it, and I'm very happy with it. And I'm more or less kind of content to work with more Nothos.
So at the beginning of this discussion, Charles made some comments about how live bearers weren't on his list. partially because you just put them in a tank and just forget about them and babies show up. That was actually the criteria I used to make my list of easy breeders, because to me, that's the easy breeder. So I'm going to stick with the killifish theme, and I'm going with Gardner Achilles. In a densely planted aquarium with a lot of nice grass, a pair of Gardner Achilles fed flake food, you will get babies.
That's amazing. Yep. And I just want to add that the fish that we just discussed, our first three, are some of the most beautiful freshwater aquarium fish, particularly the killies that you're talking about. Yeah, so
that's very true.
Yeah. In the predation from the parents isn't going to be that much of a problem.
You'll lose some. That's where you need some cover, and floating, big, thick masses of floating plants make a huge difference. I used Nias grass, and big, thick masses of floating Nias grass in a 5.5 gallon tank. One pair of see, now you got me in Nothabron. One pair of gardener Achilles, fed flake food, baby showed up.
Very cool.
And that's valid.
Yeah.
Like, that's a really cool strategy. I just like being like hands on.
Yeah.
Right.
And when you're breeding, you don't need 500 babies to call it a success.
Yeah.
One or two is pretty awesome. Even if it's one or two at a time for a while and they just build up.
Well, you know, part of our audience for this is going to be
six.
Yeah. How do I,
there
how,
we go.
That's, how do I get six?
How do I get six? So you can get those BAP points. For those of you not a member of an aquarium club or not a member of the Grand Valley Aquarium Club, this is the Breeders Award Program, which is just a friendly competition that happens within the club. And to get your point, you have to turn in six fry that are at least 60 days old. And gardener Achilles, I did that way. Now, four times I ended up with five fry, but I did end up with six and turned in all six fry and got my point for gardener eyes. With very, very little effort.
Sometimes fate is just against you.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
That's a good one. I can't overstate how pretty they are.
They're gorgeous.
They're wonderful.
Yeah. Cool.
And I just want to throw out there that if you've listened to some of our podcasts or once some of our videos, I'm like, killifish, let's first off just mention the myth of they only live like 6 months. No, that's their life expectancy in the wild. They have a habitat where they dry up every six
that's
months.
That's the life expectancy of annual killifish in the wild.
Thank you.
Sorry. That's important.
They live as long as they're in water?
Yeah. Yeah. Funny how that works.
Keep them wet. They're fine.
So, you know, if you get yourself a pair of gardener Achilles, I think 3 to 5 years is a reasonable like expectation.
Oh, yeah.
Similar to a domestic strain betta.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
All right, I cheated on this one because we were not very specific on our requirements. So
cheating
I put
allowed.
Neocaridina shrimp. It's not a fish, but it is an easy breeder.
That is definitely easy.
The big benefit to these is nano. They're a great tiny project to do. You can breed neocaridinas in 1 gallon if you wanted to.
Easily.
5 or 2.5, great size for them. Super easy. Feed them. Don't have anything that eats them or eats the babies. I will say pretty much every fish does. So if you don't have fish and you have neos that you're feeding, you will have as many as you want.
As long as you do have some fish that will eat some of the babies, if there's plenty of cover, you could still get an established breeding population.
Oh, yeah. And most tiny fish really only eat the baby shrimp. Yeah. So I think a female on average produces 30 to 60 eggs a month. So if you've got 5 females and a group of 6 fish that take out 30 every month, whatever.
You've still got plenty
of shrimp.
Yeah. And fat, happy fish.
I think some people do have the opinion that they're difficult or sensitive. And I think that has to do with a lot of people buying their shrimp online from different water parameters, shipping stress. If you're getting shrimp that are born and raised in your local water, you should not have an issue with neocaridinas.
They should be super hard.
Yeah.
I have a slightly different perspective on that, but my perspective is I think too many people are trying too hard to change their water. When I'm just like, no, just commit to the water you have and let your shrimp do their thing. They will be just fine.
Mm-hmm.
With neocaridinas. With
neocaridinas,
that's not necessarily true, but with neocaridinas, absolutely. Grand Rapids water is really good for neocaridinas.
Yeah. Super soft, borderline RO water, you will need to add minerals for your shrimp.
Right.
Here, minerals are not a concern. You do not need to put cuttle bone in Grand Rapids tap water to get calcium in it. Trust me, it has plenty.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. That's my next one.
I like it.
Simple.
That's fun, even though I think you're cheating. But
it is cheating.
That's okay.
Nobody ever said fish. I will play back the recording.
We all said breeders.
Easy breeders.
Easy breeders. So technically not cheating.
I'm going to comment on the neocaridinas a little bit, and this is going to apply to live bearers too. I think most people who breed these things should anticipate that they're going to need to cull to try yes. and maintain or to improve the line. With the shrimp, it's really easy. Amy mentioned everything likes to eat them. So every once in a while, I'll find the clear shrimp, pull them out, and feed them to my breeding barbs.
Yeah, shrimp are food.
Yep.
And reintroducing new genetics is always a good idea, too. I think that's why a lot of crashes happen, is because they're just so tremendously inbred.
I felt like years ago when cherry shrimp kind of first hit the market, we didn't have to worry about it with the original line of cherries. Like, we were just producing them like crazy. We weren't introducing new blood. They maintained that color.
Yeah.
They went super easy. All of these shrimp now that are messed with and genetically modified, line bred to get very specific colors, those are the ones that are unstable. But I think the original cherry shrimp is pretty stable.
Yeah, I think so. I haven't heard too many tank crashes with just cherries.
Yeah.
And it might be that there's just enough of a mix because they're a more established strain. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And I think that's wild Neocardinia davidsoni. Look, cherry shrimp. That's what they are.
No, they're brown.
Are they?
Mm-hmm.
Bummer.
Yeah, they're like, so this is one of the things, and anybody comes in and is like, I want a red one, a blue one, a yellow one. That clear with the stripe down the back where you'll see they'll start coming out, that's the wild type. That sort of clearish brownish color.
Okay.
So if you're mixing shrimp, that's probably what you're going to end up with because that's the dominant genetics. You've got to stick with one color. Sorry.
And shrimp, the Neocardinias don't live that long.
No.
So you will end up with a population of brown shrimp, and it won't take long.
No, it won't. So that's the wild type.
Okay.
But, you know, getting back to you only need like a 2-gallon tank for a small colony. If you want a red one, set up a 2-gallon tank, and you want a blue one, set up a 2-gallon mm-hmm. tank.
Right.
It's super easy.
Yep.
Yeah.
I like it.
It is interesting that red. I don't know the history of that red strain. I would like to go back and figure out mm-hmm. who, if it was developed from wild type or if it's a mutation or something.
I never once saw a wild type back in the beginning of all of this.
You've never seen like, oh, wild type Neocardina.
Yeah.
$2 or whatever. I don't know.
Interesting.
That's, yeah. I want to know what the history is there, but.
Sounds I can't help you here. I'm not a shrimp geneticist.
Oh, but I think you're about to be.
Let me write this down.
Charles will find the scientific paper, the scientific documentation for the origin of the cherry shrimp.
Yeah.
Where were we? Charles, right?
Charles, yeah.
Yep.
What you got?
I put Corydoras aeneas.
Definitely one of the easier Cory cats.
Yeah. That was the first Cory cat I ever bred. And the process for me was a 10-gallon tank that I did a 50% gallon, like, water change with water that was a few degrees cooler. And when I say a few degrees, I mean, like, 2 degrees Fahrenheit, people. Like, just a little bit, okay? And then increased flow. That ended up being the trigger for me. And that group ended up being the consistent spawner at the time in my bedroom. And that meant that... I've mentioned to other people that they're like, oh, I just can't get this group of Cory cats to spawn. I'm like, do you have a group of aeneas that you can get to spawn regularly? And most of the time they'll say yes. And I'm like, all right, get those to spawn, then take some of that water and put it in the tank with the reluctant spawners. I don't know what it is, some sort of hormone or something, but it never failed for me with what I tried to get some reluctant group of Cory cats to spawn if you used Aeneas Cory cat spawn water.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah.
I love these kinds of breeding strategies. That's the fun part of a discussion like this.
And I will throw out there, that is not something I picked up online. That is not something that I figured out myself. That is something that, and I don't even remember who it was because this was like, I wasn't really in GVAC at that point, but I was at an event with Sue and I was talking about Cory cats and one of the older guys in the club goes, try this. And that's where I picked up that trick. Whoever you are, I wish I knew your name. I wish I could thank you. I got several other species of Cory cats spawned because of that trick. So whoever you are, thank you very much.
That's so
how'd you
cool.
raise the fry?
So the nice thing about Cory cat fry is that since they're bottom dwelling, they are not very picky. I just did a bare bottom 10 and they can go, my experience has been they can go straight to powdered foods.
Did you remove the eggs?
No, I removed the parents.
Remove the parents. Good call.
That was just always easier for me.
Yeah.
And if you have a bare bottom 10, that's so easy. You scoop them up. That's not difficult.
Yeah. And with that particular group, they kind of got used to the process where they're like, oh, we're just going to another tank. All right, cool.
It's moving day. Yep.
Straight to powdered foods, microworms, stuff like that. They're not picky. If they can find something that smells good on the bottom, they'll eat it.
Nice.
Sponge grunge.
Sponge grunge is always a good first food, particularly with some of the really small stuff.
Yeah. After that, it's just churn and burn of water changes and feeding them until they're big enough to go somewhere else.
Growing them up. I've never done a Cory cat.
They're fun.
I might have to try one soon. So I am sticking with the, I tried to pick an easy fish from all different categories. So the first one did was a killifish. Second one's going to be an egg scatterer. And it's going to be another one that I completely did on accident. I had zero involvement in their reproduction, other than I had a tank that was doing, I'm going to call it moderately okay. And it actually started with a group of white clouds that I bought as feeder fish. So white cloud mountain minnows, super, super easy. And I bought them as feeder fish because I had another creature that we were trying to get to eat, and I didn't want to feed a goldfish because goldfish are bad. White clouds as feeder fish really aren't necessarily great either, but I've learned since then. It's okay. And we stuck them in a tank, and we stuck a half a dozen in the tank, and whatever we were trying to feed, I don't remember what it was, didn't eat it and died a bit later, and we removed it, and there was these white clouds in the tank that I sort of took care of. And by sort of, I mean they probably got a 10% water change once a month because I had my fish room going and I was paying attention, and I threw flake food every once in a while. And about 2 months later, I had twice as many white clouds as what I started with. They just showed up.
Wow.
Super easy. That's all it took. Kind of like Neocardinia shrimp.
Yeah.
Have them in a tank with a little bit of cover and nothing that's going to eat them.
And that's it.
That's it. There was no heater on the tank. White clouds can handle temperatures down into the mid-60s. They were probably in the low 70s in that tank, but mid-60s are fine for white clouds.
Yeah, that's a great factor to talk about because I think you could set up a white cloud breeding project for $50.
I think you could set up a white cloud breeding project for $25. 10-gallon tank, sponge filter, air pump.
Yeah.
$26, you need airline tubing. Dang it.
You know what? I'm counting a lid and saying I'm correct.
Yeah, if you filled it with plastic plants because you do need some cover. Okay, then you got to buy the plastic plants, but you can usually get those really cheap.
Or put it in a window and throw in some Nias.
Yeah.
Or spawning mops. Yeah. My first spawning mops were made by stealing yarn from my mom. Yep.
And stealing yarn from your mom is free.
It's free. Yes. So yes, you could set up a white cloud breeding setup so cheap. If you really wanted to increase your yield, 2 10-gallon tanks, good light, moderate light, a pile of Nias grass, and move the adults every 2 or 3 weeks, and you would just produce more white clouds than you could probably sell.
I would argue for like Java moss or something, one of the mosses in that genus, not just because I think it's a better cover for fry, but also it's a lot easier to sell moss than it is Nias grass.
True. However, most egg scattering fry, their instinct is to shoot for the surface. Nias grass is a plant that ends up being a mass at the surface, whereas Java moss ends up being a mass at the bottom. So yeah. Although the eggs are more protected with Nias grass, the fry are a little more protected with, the eggs are more protected with Java moss, the fry are a little more protected with the Nias grass.
True.
So most of my, not most, there were definitely choices that were made with whether or not it should be a tank with Nias grass or moss in it. And sometimes if you do both, which you can pull off, you have to harvest carefully, then you're covered. I mean, then you're just, throw whatever you want in the tank. Not quite, but pretty close. Throw whatever you want in the tank and you get babies.
Yeah. But I will throw out there's always a demand for more moss and all the time.
That's very true.
Although lately, it's been the same for Nias.
That's
Nobody's
true.
Got it these days.
Yeah, well, and after this podcast, everybody's going to want Nias.
I was just talking to you about that today. Anyway, all right. Well, I'll do mine because it's kind of a piggyback.
Cool.
Similar for so many of these hearty egg scatterers, it's going to be the same exact story.
Absolutely.
They're going to eat the eggs and fry, but if you really carefully plan it or if you have a ton of cover, then they might just pop up. Otherwise, you can just swap the adults out from time to time. So I went with gold barbs because that's one we've had pop up by accident lately.
Yep, that's a good call.
They can take crushed flake fairly quickly and super hardy. They've been fairly easy to grow out and great bright colors, fun fish to have.
I'm going to piggyback off of that too, because same exact strategy, zebra danios.
Yeah. So and you could then go just, on and on
let's
and
just
on.
Let's just do a list mm-hmm. of, I bet we're going to, okay, let's do it flash style. Okay. And so here's the setup. We're going to say it's 2 20-gallon long aquariums and we're going to put Java moss and Nias grass in each tank. Mm-hmm. We're going to do 10% water changes once a week. We're going to heat it to 78 degrees and we're going to have a sponge filter in each tank and a cheap, easy light on each tank. Okay. And the method is going to be, we're going to put 6 adults in one tank, keep them there for 2 weeks and then move them into the other tank. And you're going to have babies. Mm-hmm. So white clouds, gold barbs.
With cherry barbs would Danios. Be similar.
Okay. So now we're going to do, let's do it this way. Okay. Amy.
Serpe tetras.
Chopra danios.
Odessa barbs.
I'm just going to keep thinking of Hyphus abricons. So orange flame tetras.
You know, some of those are going to be, you're going to have to mess with water on those.
Not the captive bred strains of like both flame tetras, lemon tetras.
Yeah, that's true.
You think so?
Yeah.
Let's try it.
I was going to say black skirt tetras.
Diamond tetras.
You're
done it.
You're killing me. I'm already out.
Okay. Rosy barbs, Odessa barbs, emperor tetras.
Emperor tetras. Just going to throw this out here. Those do not ship well. So if we get people that are a consistent source for those, that would be great.
The emperor tetras?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. But they're easy.
They're easy, but they do not ship well.
That's true.
By the way,
that's
we do true. Have a local source for them. Oh, good.
I would like 10,000 of them. It's a gorgeous fish. It's really underappreciated.
So that's like one of the easiest setups in the world.
What? Dwarf neon rainbows.
That's on my list. So those,
sorry.
Those, I don't even think you need the moss and the Nias grass.
They will just scatter everywhere.
Yeah. So dwarf neon rainbows were on my list. And as many of you know, we quarantine all of our fish, our freshwater fish for 2 weeks. And we put dwarf neon rainbows in a bare bottom tank with a sponge filter and nothing else in the tank. We put, it was either a dozen or 25 in the tank. We kept them in there for 2 weeks and we moved them out and we didn't put something else in the tank right away. And 3 days later, there were 30 babies swimming around in the tank.
Amazing.
That was just nothing done to breed those fish. Super easy. They're on my list because I'm trying to get, you know, all these different categories. And I would put a rainbow fish in a different category as a tetra or a barb. But, I mean, not really. They're an easy egg scatterer.
Yeah, the mechanism is the same, but the fish is much different.
Right.
My understanding is rainbow fish have a slightly longer, like, fry period.
They are a lot slower growing and the fry are a lot smaller.
But fun fact for everyone out there, this is a trick given to me by Mike Manji. Reefroids.
Yes.
Happens to be an amazing bite-sized food for a lot of small fry. Yes.
Many rainbow fish can be grown that way. Now, we tried that with Bosmani rainbows and turquoise rainbows and the method wasn't the same.
But the parva rainbows, which are another more dwarf rainbow actually worked.
They did do that, yeah.
Which, not on purpose, but that happened to us recently too.
Yep. I think the difference is, and we're going to try this, I'm pretty sure the difference is some of those rainbows are mop spawners and some of them are egg scatterers. So I bet if we take the Bosmani rainbows and just put some mops in there, do the same thing, they'll lay the eggs in the mops as opposed to just scattering them all willy-nilly.
Well, then they might be a better fit for the moss tank we're talking about.
Yeah, I like it. That's true. That's yeah. true.
I will add to the Reefroids thing, if you want something that's freshwater directed, the New Life Spectrum Grow Blend has a similar texture.
Yeah, that stuff's great. That's what I use in my fish room.
Yeah, but both are fantastic.
Yep. You can't go wrong either way.
No.
Nope.
All right. We jumped around a little bit. No,
we did.
I think we're back at, but you did, the Dwarf Neon Rainbow officially on your list, or is that one of your bonuses?
Let's say it's one of your bonuses.
The Gold Barb was one of mine.
I got two left.
Yeah, I have two left as well.
Okay.
Ben's like, I have 15 left.
I have
left.
Six left.
How many of those would fit into this moss tank? Just for fun.
So in a way, two others would fit into the moss tank. Sort of.
Okay.
Okay.
A little differently, but sort of. And
let's actually talk about those because I'm interested
now.
We'll
just say it's your turn because I think we have the same amount left, so you get another turn.
So guppies and Endler's live bearers would both fit into the moss tank.
Oh, sure.
Right.
In a
they
different
would
way.
Spew babies. Only you
spew. That's the best way to put it. They just come shooting out.
That's kind of what happens with those guys. Yeah. And you pull the parents out and put them into a different tank to protect the babies. So, Endler's, guppies. A lot of live bears, not all of them, Charles. Some of them take a lot more work.
Some of them
than
take
that.
A lot of work.
Yeah.
But I was speaking to like the easy ones that people put on every internet list.
Yeah.
Right. But I will throw out there that just because I don't like to breed them myself because it's not the way I like to breed, those lime green Endlers we got in, they are gorgeous.
Are they? Yeah. I haven't even looked at them.
They're
beautiful.
It's a crazy
color.
They're like a true lime green.
Nice.
Like, I threw them out there as like a suggestion because I was like, I was kind of being like going out on a limb and they came in. And I was like, whew, those are they're actually pretty.
They are actually lime green.
I will have to check those out.
The blue lyretail guppies too. Both of those are colors we don't get that often. That powder blue and that lime green.
Mm-hmm. Oh. I would say it's more of like a sky blue.
Yeah, I guess powder blue would be a little bit more lighter metallic. This is actually a true blue.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Very cool. I like it.
So I'm just throwing those out there because I'm like, that's not what I like to breed, but I don't judge anyone that does because they are beautiful fish.
Nice.
That so plays into why Endlers and guppies are fun to a lot of people. It is kind of that like, that strain is the one I really like. And it's a more personal thing. And there are so many different varieties that you can say, I like these. I want to make them as good as I possibly can. And they'll be kind of your own little thing.
It's really fun when you meet somebody who's really into particular guppy strains.
Yeah.
There's a guy over on the east side of the state that I know that wins awards for IFGA, which is the something Federal Guppy Association. But it could be International Federal because that would make it IFGA. I'll have to figure out what that acronym stands for. But he wins awards and he has some of the most amazing guppies that you would ever see.
Wow. Yeah. And that's something everybody gets. Like and there are some strains that I'm like, whatever. But when there's a really cool one, you get it. Like you understand why it's cool.
There, I make a strong distinction between someone who has guppies breeding their tanks and someone who breeds guppies.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a big difference between having guppies show up in your tank and maintaining a line.
Yes. That's a line that has to be made.
Yeah.
And live bears.
And the people who maintain lines, they are hardcore, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They are so cool. Yeah.
They got to have some predators around because of that dirty little word, culling.
Mm-hmm.
Dun, dun, dun.
But they are the great equalizer because somebody who does it for the intense, like, hobby level, like, this is my passion, I am breeding guppies, and the person who has some in their community tank and they're breeding, pretty much are using the same process.
Yeah, that's true.
I was like, that's one thing that I think gets really underappreciated about live bears, is that they're one of the few families of fish that, like, has a large body of people who are at every level in the hobby in it. They're like the people who got their first tank and the people who've been doing it for 60 years and they have 20 lines. And it's like live bears have all of that. Like
there's room for everybody in there.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's true for most families in fish keeping, but live bears just manages to maintain that innately.
Yeah. That's a great point.
Yep.
Cool.
Love it.
All right. So my next one is going to be bristlenose plecos.
Nice.
Yeah. These are another good cave spawner. The males are going to care for the babies at the youngest stage. And when they come out, they're mainly eating biofilm and other random gunk that's around the tank. Sponge grunge.
Yep.
No need to mess with water.
Nope.
No need to mess with live food.
And everybody wants them, so you don't have to worry about what to do with them because any store will take your bristlenose plecos.
We get several people who trade in bristlenose plecos in here, and we have a colony that we maintain here that I'm consistently pulling from, and we cannot keep up.
Yeah.
Every single aquarium needs a bristlenose, at least a bristlenose, if not two in it.
Pretty much. I mean, as long as it's at least 20 gallons. Some of them do get up to 6 inches long, and it is really hard to know what hybrid that's you have.
Okay. You're fine.
Most of them are going to be in the 3 or 4 inch range, though. I don't see them often get bigger than that.
True.
But they are a hybrid fish, so we don't really know. They're like the only hybrid we really like.
I did have a conversation earlier about those alien bettas, though.
Oh, really?
And I was like, that's a rare case of a hybrid where I'm like, all right, I'm on board. Nah. This is pretty cool.
You got me there.
I don't know if this is bursting a bubble or not, but most of the fancy type sword tails and platies, hybrids.
It's not bursting my bubble. It might be bursting somebody else's. Same for guppies, though. Really, guppies and endlers are often hybridized, right? Unless you have a true strain.
Not necessarily, because the endlers were pulled from Psyllia wengii. Was pulled from Psyllia reticulata just in the last 10 years. And guppies have been around as Psyllia reticulata for a very long time. Now, there are definitely some strains out there that are hybrids.
I just mean your average mixed guppies in a store are often hybridized at some. Or mixed endlers, I should say.
Mixed endlers are probably a hybrid with Psyllia wengii and Psyllia reticulata.
Yeah. I meant to say mixed endlers from the beginning. I think mixed guppies are more likely to be just guppies.
Just guppies.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you have endlers where your females are like 3 times the size of your males, you've got guppy
in
that.
You've got guppies in there.
So.
Cool. Yep. Well, not much more to say about bristlenose. I think just have a pair in a cave.
Have fun.
There you go.
Enjoy how cute the babies are.
They are. Like, they're just tiny bristlenose plecos. They are
Although
so cute.
Some ways to increase yield, blanched vegetables. Cucumbers, spinach, blanch them, pop them in there, babies go nuts on them.
One of my favorite things in the world was I had a group of bristlenose plecos about 10 years ago. And before I'd go to bed, I would have like a magnet that I have two magnets that I would stick together. And that's what I would use to weigh down a bunch of spinach.
Nice.
And as I was walking away after the lights turned off, you could hear them coming out and munching on it. And then you would wake up in the morning and they would get as close to the magnet as they could get their suction cups on. And it's just like, it was so funny.
It either looks adorable or it looks like the stuff nightmares are made of.
Yeah.
No in between.
So the next thing on my list is I put Betta smeridina.
As easy.
Yes. Nice. That is by far the easiest betta I have ever worked with. The wild type bubble nesters, in my experience, are way better fathers than any of the domestic strains I've ever worked with. I've had some finickiness working with the Unimaculata complex because there's definitely a learning curve for those guys figuring out how to be a father. And I haven't worked with...
Some people, too.
Yeah. I haven't really worked extensively with anything in the Cocina complex, but man, I think if you're going with a wild-type Splendens complex betta, Smeridina, Imbellus, and Mahakiensis, like, those are all really easy fish to work with. They're a standard bubble nester. The care is more or less the same as you would for a Splendens, except they're good at being parents.
Water conditions?
I didn't have to change anything.
What about feeding the babies?
I got mine onto powdered, the New Life Spectrum powdered food right away.
Just immediately. No live food needed.
No live food needed.
Perfect.
And I got enough to BAP them, so.
That's what you want. That famous 6 fry at 60 days.
Yep.
Yep.
I also know that I haven't worked with them, so that's why I didn't put them on my list. But everyone I know in the club who's worked with Betta Falks.
I've heard that one too. I haven't tried that one either, but I've heard that one too.
So that's why I put Smeridina, because I was like, that was so easy.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
And there's like a level of prestige to being like, I bred a wild Betta. Like, because it sounds like a really difficult thing to do, but more accessible than I think a lot of people think.
And then,
have you bred one?
No.
Oh, then you're the only one of us that hasn't. Time to step it up, Amy.
I've only successfully bred one fish.
And it was a buffalo head. So you definitely get some points for that because it's not like a...
Well, I did not do anything for that. I didn't even feed the fry.
That's pretty cool.
But I have a planted tank, so there's a lot of gunk.
Right. I had buffalo heads in a planted tank for close to 10 years.
I think...
And it was pears. And I never got any fry.
Were they like, did they pair off? They hung out together?
Yeah. Yep. Never got fry. I had two pairs in the tank.
I wonder if the difference then is... I have a really deep substrate. They can burrow.
Yeah, it could be substrate.
Because they're not really, like, they don't seem to really cave spawn. They dig down and burrow underneath.
I definitely had big, the substrate was larger rocks.
Okay, that could have been
below
it.
That, there was a better substrate. But the large rocks, they wouldn't have been able to move around.
I just have dirt, so that's just normal.
Perfect.
I don't think we've ever had an episode with this many Easter eggs before.
No.
I was just processing what's happening here.
Yeah.
We're learning. We talk about this stuff all the time, and yet in a conversation like this, we learn so much from each other.
I think my next fish might be an Easter egg.
I have one Betta smeridina agnatoke.
Okay.
And then let's move on.
Yeah.
So as an example, a specific example, me being like, wow, this fish is a way better father than any domestic Betta I've worked with is, so those bubble nests, each bubble has a finite lifespan.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
At some point that bubble will pop.
Mm-hmm.
And so my experience with the domesticated Bettas is every once in a while, a bubble with an egg with it would pop. And the male would look at it like, I'll get to that eventually. And then...
Or is that food?
Yeah. My smeridina male, when a bubble popped, I don't care where he was in the tank, but his entire body language was, oh no!
My babies!
And he would come rushing across the tank, catch it, and very carefully put it back.
Now so I need cute. To try those guys. Dang it. I don't think my display up here is going to be enough.
You could probably fit a whole rack of 2.5s or 5s behind your desk there. There's an empty wall. Mm-hmm. Not to give you any ideas.
Excellent.
All right. I think it's your turn, bud.
Peacock gudgeons.
And that is a bit of a loop.
They were easy.
Really?
Yep.
I don't know. They're essentially gobies. I'm trying to think.
They
I don't know
goby.
How they breed.
They're in family gobiidae.
Well, so one caveat here, they're easy if you can find a female. Yeah,
That's true. When we get batches of peacock gudgeons in, we either get all males or we get an exactly 50-50 split. And it's about 1 out of 10 shipments is an exact 50-50 split. The other shipments, all males.
Wow.
So I just wanted to talk about that. Move on. Tell your story.
All right. So peacock gudgeons. The little ceramic little log towers that have like three, it looks like three hollow logs stacked on top of each other that are about as big around as a finger.
Okay.
Two of those in a tank, planted tank, the male will immediately take charge of that spot. He'll entice a female in, they'll do what they need to do. He will kick her out, and then they actually are fantastic fathers. And I always knew, like, he would come out and be out of the cave for about 2 or 3 days, and then he would be back in with another batch.
Wow.
Just over and over and over again. Raise the fry on, crushed flake food, planted tank, easy.
I would never have thought, just because they're gobies.
Yeah, they look challenging.
No, they look challenging, and they're challenging. That family is generally challenging. Wow.
And guess what? Another egregiously beautiful fish.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and this is genuine because I don't know anything about this fish. Mm-hmm. This sounds like a strategy similar to like if someone was trying to breed like sticklebacks.
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
Except it's a non-native fish, so you can get them really easy.
as
long as you can get females.
Sounds like another one we need to try down in the breeding lab so that we can get some... females.
There just need to be more of them around anyway. Mm-hmm. Like that's a fish. So much of breeding is I want more of these around.
I just want more of them to exist in the world. Okay.
Yeah. And that's definitely one of them to me. Underrated. Yeah. That could have gone into one of this our underrated fish.
This is why we have the breeding lab, is so that we can do things like this. And maybe Pico Gudgeon is a perfect addition to that system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're going to need more tanks.
I think so.
We're going to need a bigger breeder lab.
where's the meme? Yep. So there you go, Peacock Gudgeons. Cool. You guys each have one more, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, good, because I have one more as well.
My last one is another bubble nester, so I won't harp on it too long, but this is another fish that we have had breed in our quarantine tanks.
I was hoping somebody would bring this one up.
Blue paradise fish.
That's not the fish out there you're going to bring up, but that's a great choice.
We've had Fry come out in a completely bare quarantine tank with like a dozen of them in it. The Fry didn't make it, shocker, but they made it a while. And they should be able to take powdered foods or crushed flakes pretty quickly. They're pretty big at the time they're born, and the dad will take care of them. Beautiful fish, really, really hardy. You could do them in a 10, a pair. We already went over bubble nesting mechanisms for a while, so I don't feel like I need to, but...
It's another fish you don't need a heater for.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You can, but they don't need it.
Throw out the anabantoid you were thinking of.
Honey grummies.
Oh, I went back and forth, but I went with this one because that's the one that we've had a, like actual Fry come out of.
I think that they're easier than honey grummies, so I think you chose wisely.
And I'm just going to throw this out here, is I think people really underappreciate, I mentioned really good fathers with the wild types. I think people really underappreciate how useful having a good father fish is. Because trust me, he is way better at figuring out what those things need than you will ever be. So like a domesticated strain of anything that's kind of like meh about the Fry, or a wild type like a paradise fish, honey gourami, or a Barrett's Meridina.
Angelfish.
Discus. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're amazing parents. Right. And so don't underestimate that and don't cut them short. Like if they don't succeed the first few times, don't pull the Fry. They're learning. Trust me.
And they will learn.
They will learn. And trust me, once they figure that out, it is way easier than any process you would do.
Even the process of just catching the things out. Yeah. So I love paradise fish. I think they're something that deserves a little more love. They are cheap. They are just vibrantly colorful and hardy. And you can't go wrong.
That fish is I would call it an original. I mean, that fish has been in the hobby for.
It's one of the first fish to be imported in for the aquarium trade because they could survive the shipment on a boat or whatever. Right.
You can find really cool like painted plates of them from like the late 1800s.
Yeah.
That's how long people have been keeping paradise fish.
They are so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great piece of history and great fun fish to have.
Yep. I would love to look into their wild population. I know nothing about that. And all of a sudden I had this moment of, hey, if they've been in the hobby that long, are they still in the wild?
That is a good question.
Yeah.
They're Southeast Asian.
Mm-hmm.
That's about all I have.
Right. But white clouds, I believe, are not in the wild anymore.
Yeah, those are, I think, considered functionally extinct.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I think paradise fish are still in the wild. I will look it up. I just wrote it down.
Perfect.
In the next podcast, I will have a couple things for us to...
Excellent. I love it.
They strike me as something that would come from a little bit bigger of a habitat than some of the smaller anabantoids, just because they're big.
But they are bubble nesters, so they would have to come from pretty slow-moving water.
Yeah, so that would be a little bit more threatened. I don't know. Yeah. There's a lot to get into there.
Yeah.
Cool. I'll find out.
I know you will.
All right,
Charles.
What's
your last one?
I put cherry barbs.
Cool.
Yep.
Now, I specifically put this down for several reasons. A, it falls under the egg scatterer category that we harped on really hard here.
Yeah.
It's the first fish I ever bred.
Very cool.
And they are like... I'm trying to think of how I want to word this. They are one of the most sexually dimorphic species I've ever worked with. So like for me, that was actually a big selling point for me trying them out, because immediately knowing whether I had a boy or a girl.
With some fish, that's a real challenge. Like you don't
like
know.
Like peacock gudgeons.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I just, that the idea that I would immediately know and I could work with that just gave me the little bit boost of confidence I needed to try it. and I succeeded, and I'm still breeding fish today. Like, right. So I have to give a lot of credit to cherry barbs, because I'm like, I don't think I would be a fish breeder now if it wasn't for that fish.
I totally get where you're coming from with that. And I think just about everybody that really gets into breeding has that fish.
Yeah.
That one, wow, I made more of these.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's powerful.
I maintained that particular group I was working with for 5 generations.
That's very cool.
And they're a common fish, but you don't need to breed the rarest fish or whatever to make it justifiable. There's a local guy who had this strain of cherry barbs that was so fantastic. Those common farm bred fish, they get a little bit washed out. They get a little bit, they're not being bred for maximum health and beauty. They're being bred for as many as possible. So a few generations of him breeding his cherry barbs, and they were completely different fish. They were gorgeous, bright, vibrant red all the way throughout their body, instead of being like red-ish the way that those farm bred cherry barbs are. So you can really put your stamp on a fish like that.
Yeah, you can make it your own really easily.
I think that goes right down to what we were talking about with some of the guppy and other live bear strains.
Exactly.
When you have somebody that cares, the quality that can come out of that is notable.
There's a reason there are some fish that we will not order wholesale, because we have such fantastic local versions available.
Yep.
And I want that list to keep growing, guys.
Yes. Yeah. So. Honestly.
Right.
Yeah. We'd love to get our stuff from local breeders, because we know it's usually going to be much better.
Plus, I just like the stories that they tell me when they come in.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Much better than the stories we're selling today, although we're doing pretty good.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. How many more do you have left?
Well, I'm struggling with the last two. I'm going to do one of them because you got to touch on this topic, and one of them because you can't have a list like this without including this fish. So just about any mouth-brooding Malawi cichlid needs to be on that list, because if you put a group or a pair into a tank and they don't kill each other, they will make babies.
We have had that happen in our big display.
So I'm gonna actually just narrow it down and say yellow labs. Yellow labs, you don't have to provide some caves. Feed them cichlid food. When you see small ones, feed them smaller cichlid food, and you're done. You're going to have females, or is it males?
I think the females are the ones that mouth brood.
I think they are in that one. I think they're maternal, not a paternal. You will have parents holding fry soon, and at remarkably small sizes. It's a fish that gets to about 5 inches. They will start holding at 1.5 inches.
Wow.
It's ridiculous.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're babies.
And you don't have to do anything other than keep them from killing each other. But usually with yellow labs, they're on the more peaceful side with each other, and they'll colonize pretty well.
Will the parents recognize the fry after they release them, or will they eat them?
They don't want to eat baby fish very
much. I get the other algae eaters. Herbivores, I should say.
Actually, one of the really cool methods that I saw was, so with African cichlids, one of the best methods is to have some kind of a rock structure in there. And so this guy who was breeding them on a pretty regular basis, he started his rock structure out by using some egg crate boxes. And he put those in there and then stacked the rocks around those egg crate boxes. So you couldn't see the egg crate boxes. So egg crate is this fluorescent light diffuser. It's this white grid that I think they're roughly a little less than 1/2 inch square. And the fry, once they were released, could hide out in those little boxes, and the parents couldn't get into the boxes.
Well, that's a great idea.
And it was a factory. I mean, he produced so many yellow labs, it was gosh darn ridiculous.
And then you don't have to give up any of the look of a display. Yeah. Like, that's really cool.
Yeah. And actually, he was doing that with yellow labs and Demason eyes, which, although they will hybridize, they're unlikely to. So he was getting Demason eye fry and yellow lab fry just.
And that feels like if you got a hybrid, you would know. Like, that's a pretty.
It's a pretty obvious one.
It's a pretty blatant hybrid.
Right.
Neat.
So yeah, super, 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 super easy.
Yeah, we have had babies. I mean, we've had hybrid Mbuna show up and grow up in our, we have that 180 that has fish that are 5 inches long, fish that are 10 inches long,
yep.
a bunch of different ones. And we've had a couple of babies grow up and survive just fine because there are plenty of hiding places.
Yeah. Yeah. They can do it. Hybridization. If you're going to talk about breeding Malawi cichlids, you have to talk about hybridization.
Yeah. And we were not intentionally breeding them like that.
If your intention is to breed Malawi cichlids, don't mix them. There are a few exceptions. There are some things you can get away with, but they better be different fish so that you know if they're hybridized. If you have a mixed Mbuna tank, do not sell the babies. You will have hybrids. That's all you will have. That's what they do.
Yeah.
They're so prolific. All of those Mbunas are just so prolific. They just constantly in a good, healthy African cichlid tank, you'll see parents with mouthfuls.
But hear me out. This is another case where I'm like, I feel like people kind of like when they set up an African cichlid tank and they want to do every color.
Yeah.
It's not, we talk about this a lot in the store. It's not really a style I get into.
Yeah.
But imagine that same like 180 in someone's living room, but it's got like 40 yellow labs.
It's a gorgeous look.
Yeah, like that would catch anyone's eye.
Yeah.
It's impactful from across the room versus when you get up close and there's a bunch of, it's just cohesion. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's just something about like think about it. Like most of the time you dress yourself. Yes, there are people that like to wear every color and that's fine. But most of us commit to one palette on any given day.
Yeah, you know, I like that.
Checkerboard, rainbow, stars and stripes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That.
Yep.
And there
people
is,
look at you and they're like, ah.
And there is value in doing that.
Right.
But think about how you want your display to impact people. Do you want that to be something that they have to walk up to appreciate? Or do you want that to be something that they see across the room and say, I need to walk up to that to get a closer look at it?
I agree. I think that's a really good point.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Totally. Totally. So I have to make one more point about hybrids in Malawi cichlid tanks. If you are wondering whether or not your fish will hybridize, the answer is yes. Right? Because as a scientist, I don't use this word often, but all Malawi cichlids have the potential to hybridize with all other Malawi cichlids.
That blows my mind.
Yep. Any one of them without exception. And it doesn't matter if you are crossing into totally different types of fish. Like if you think of a banustis and a typical zebra, they're so different. They hybridize so easily. Yeah.
One is like twice the size of the other, pretty much.
Yeah, they hybridize so easily.
Shocking.
The classic OB peacock is a hybrid that is not a naturally occurring, and that's a cross genus hybrid. That's Alanacara mixed with Metroclima. They're completely different fish that hybridize like crazy.
Wow.
So if your goal is to breed African cichlids, and we're talking about easy breeders here, species only tanks. With very, very few exceptions. But really, species-only tanks.
That's how you're going to get the most yield with pretty much anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Agreed.
And you can make a great display tank out of it. Well, so why not go for it?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the coolest African cichlid tank I've ever seen was, well, I do have a bias here, but was just yellow labs, demacin eyes, and some Anubias plants on a huge wall of rockwork. It's gorgeous.
That'd be a good one.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, my one bonus fish.
Yes, let's hear it.
You cannot have a conversation about easy breeding fish without talking about the convict cichlid.
I almost put it on there. Frankly, I think they're cool.
I do too. I love them. They're great.
What are you talking about? These definitely belong on the hardest fish to breed.
If you ask the GVAC club president, you might say that.
A couple of the GVAC guys, we like to give crap about those. So it's always been one of my running jokes at the GVAC meetings when I've been auctioning that if you can't breed convicts, you should buy a stereo. Put them together. So my favorite anecdotal little story about breeding convict cichlids was many years ago, a friend of mine who had piranhas and wanted to feed feeder fish, but knew feeder fish were a bad idea. And buying goldfish from the store, he recognized that that was not only costing him more money than he wanted to invest in his piranhas, but also the health issue was definitely there. So he had this crazy idea. Convict cichlids are so easy to breed. I'll just breed convicts and feed them in my piranha.
I know exactly where this story is going.
Oh, yeah. So,
because I've heard similar ones many times.
Yeah, he bred his convicts. And when they're about a half of an inch long, he put them in with the piranha. And everybody has this misconception that piranha are these badass fish. They're not. They are wimpy, skittish fish with big teeth.
Come look at our piranhas and tell me if you think they're badass, if you can find them, because they're hiding.
Yeah.
And these are like 5-inch fish.
Yeah.
They do not use their teeth for defense. They use their teeth to eat stuff and that's it. So if a piranha is being chased, it's going to run away like it's being chased by something that's going to kill it. It's not. It could turn around and go and done, but they don't do that. Convicts are, they're not horribly aggressive, but they're very much hold their own.
They don't give up any ground for any reason.
Not a chance. So a piranha coming at a convict, the piranha's going to go, or the convicts go, oh yeah? Bring it on. I'm going to get you first. So
you can eat me, but you're not going to like it.
So what very quickly happened in the tank with the piranha and the quote unquote feeder convicts was he had a breeding population of convicts in his piranha tank.
Let me guess, the piranhas had to live in the top half of the tank.
They were more scared than we're used to seeing piranhas. And convicts can start breeding at 3/4 of an inch long. I mean, they get almost 5 inches, but they can start breeding really, really young.
And they are actually quite pretty, I think.
Definitely.
And they are amazing parents.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I throw this out because, so my faculty mentor in college, her research was specifically aspects of parental care in convict cichlids.
Wow.
It's valuable. I don't know that there's a cichlid that's a better parent than a convict.
No.
Watching that parental behavior in fish is one of the main attractions to keeping cichlids.
That's why I like bettas so much.
Yeah.
Because like the parental care of the males it's just so fascinating.
Yep.
Yeah, and they will defend those babies with their life.
Yes, they will.
I once had a conversation with Amy where we were talking about, you know, the tyrannosaurs in The Lost World Jurassic Park where they like they take the baby and they hunt down the trailer and they kick it over the cliff. I'm like, that's a convict cichlid. If you put it, blew it up to that size, like those things are terrifying if they were large enough to like actually bite me. Yeah,
that should have been the dad in Finding Nemo, not a clownfish of all things.
You know, that actually would have been a way more accurate movie.
Like a cichlid dad chasing his son through the Amazon.
Yeah, that would have been better. Except they're from Central America. So it should have been, you know,
but
Mexico,
I was just thinking of that big river system.
Oh,
that would
have
been so cool.
Yep.
Remake.
Yep, I agree.
So I did have, unless you guys had specific things you wanted to talk about, I did have a little blurb about aquarium breeding that I wanted to put here.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I really got into specific aspects of aquarium breeding back in 2010. And this is back when Ted Judy and Mike Helweg had their tropical fish hobbyist breeders challenge, I think it was called.
Yep.
And their goal was to see who could breed the most species in a year. And one of the really crazy takeaways I took from that was, so they were looking at their respective aquarium clubs and they managed to break down the percentage of different families that people were turning into their Breeders' Award programs.
Oh, cool.
So a little bit over 50% of them were cichlids.
Makes sense.
About 25% of them are cyprinodonts, which are killifish and live bearers.
Okay.
And then about 20% of them were tetras, barbs, rainbowfish, common anabantoids. And then about 3% of them were Cory cats, ancestrous cats, like common catfish. That meant that every other family of fish accounted for less than 2% of bapping into their clubs. And I kind of just wanted to throw that out there because it's like, A, I want to throw those out there because I'm like, look at all these things that people do habitually. Anyone can do this. Right. Like, if you think you want to go for it, go for it. Like, it's very attainable, and there are people out there that can tell you how they did it, and you can replicate their success. On the flip side, that also means there is so much uncharted territory.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
And so if that is what you want to get into, go for it. We need those innovators
right
now more than ever, because freshwater fish, believe it or not, we talk a lot about like endangered reefs and stuff around here, but freshwater fish are the most endangered group of fish in the world. I'm going off the top of my head, but if I'm remembering correctly, the only group of organisms that, like vertebrates, that's more endangered than freshwater fish are amphibians.
I bet from a, I would suspect from a losing species on a regular basis, that would make sense.
Yeah, and for the same reasons in the same habitats, basically.
Habitat destruction.
Yeah.
It's habitat destruction. They are, freshwater is not very common in the world, mm-hmm. and humans use freshwater.
A lot, yeah.
And a lot of it, and so we're habitually destroying these habitats. We were talking about live bears. The gudgeons are some of the most endangered fish in the world. Almost
right.
Like I can think of off the top of my head, several species that I know that are critically endangered, as in to our knowledge there at some point there was like 50 of them left in the wild.
Right. It's surprising the number of fish in the hobby that are extinct in the wild, and some really common, like we talked about the white clawed mountain minnow they're extinct in the wild.
Those only exist because we like them.
They're bred as feeder fish. They're that easy. There's that many of them around.
Yeah. Anyone who's keeping them is doing a service to our planet by having them around.
Right.
And these things deserve to exist just because they exist.
Yeah.
And you can do your part. And guess what? You can have fun. You can enjoy them. And you can make it your own if you want to breed this or you want to try to learn how to breed something new. I highly encourage you to. And if you have any questions that you think I might be able to answer, please let us know.
Yeah, or want to share your miseries and successes.
Yeah, I'm always happy to talk about breeding failures. I think your failures in breeding, quote unquote, tell more about you as a person than your successes.
I think there's definitely some truth in that, and whether or not you continue after a good failure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Live and learn.
They're going to happen.
Right.
They're going to happen, but you shouldn't be discouraged. It took me a year and a half to get those Betta Unimaculata to finally get Frida large enough that I could bap them.
Yeah.
But that was the proudest moment I've ever had in fish keeping breeding because they were just so, I had worked so hard for those.
Such an amazing fish.
And we had Chase came up to me and he was asking me questions about that. And when you have Chase asking you questions about anything,
right,
you feel cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
So that was my blurb on try.
Yeah.
Like try. It doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah, that's a great point.
We just went over, well, it was supposed to be 15 different species
that we
all consider easy to breed, but I think really it was more like 30 fish that without a whole lot of effort, well, some of Charles a little bit more effort, most of those fish without a whole lot of effort can be bred by the average hobbyist.
And I think we could have kept going.
I think so.
And easily.
Breeder of the Year is one of the prestigious awards with the Grand Valley Aquarium Club. And I don't know that it's ever happened that Breeder of the Year was more than 30 species in a year. We just went over about 30 species that could all be done. So there's the challenge I'm laying out there for somebody. Get Breeder of the Year. Those fish are easy to do. So do it.
Yeah.
I've also, I'm throwing this out here because I'm never going to do it myself because I don't have the desire to do it. But I've done the math on how to do, like if you were going to pre-plan Breeder of the Year and really just crush doing it. I've done that math. If you want to see those notes, come on in the store. I'm not going to explain them on the air or whatever recording we're going to call this, but I'm happy to show people.
The plans are out there to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think a future podcast is going to have to be, these were easy breeders. We're going to have some discussions and we'll have to do some research here on some fish that we know have been bred in the hobby And we have the research on how it's done, and we'll cite sources so that we can, you know, give credit where credit is due. But let's talk about some fish that are, like, if you're really up for a challenge.
Yeah, like the most rewarding fish to breed or yeah, something like that.
For sure. I like cool. that.
Yeah, I already, like it. If we're going to do that, I already have one on top.
Perfect. Yeah, I think I might be able to guess what that would be. Let's keep the conversation going. Check out the Facebook page. We'll definitely be posting a thread about this podcast when we post it. Make sure to like us on Facebook, subscribe to us on YouTube. Make sure you're subscribed to the podcast to hear more episodes. And we're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
I'm going to break down some of these methods. We'll do some quick little YouTube videos on. You want to know how this egg scattering project works? We're going to show you in an upcoming YouTube video.
And then if you have any questions, please send them to the podcast. If you have questions about why I'm so biased against live bears, please put me on the spot. Questions about breeding fish or... like just stories. I would love to read people's stories in one of these podcasts.
Yeah, I think maybe the discussion question we should post for this one would be what's the favorite fish you've bred? What's
your biggest success story?
Yeah, biggest breeding success story.
Yeah. I would word it as what's the most proud you've been from breeding a fish.
Yeah. Cool.
Yep. I like it. And in the meantime, let's have lots of fun and keep those hands wet.